From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made during the production of a film. Please Don't Hit Me, Mom tells the story of a teenage babysitter who discovers that one of the children she cares for is being physically abused by his mother. The child is played by actor Sean Astin. You probably know him from his roles in The Goonies, Rudy, and the Lord of the Rings trilogy. When Astin played the physically abused boy, the role felt close to home for him. His mother in the film was played by his real-life mother, Patty Duke, who struggled with bipolar disorder. Astin says when she was manic, she was abusive to him at home. He spoke with a Houston journalist last year about acting in the film, saying, quote, "It was awkward and uncomfortable because it was very familiar. I start laughing that nervous kind of laughter. The director had this panicked look, and my mom said, 'Just give me a minute.' We went outside, and she looked at me, and she said, 'I took a chance on you. This is my professional career,'" end quote. Astin became emotional, and Duke rushed him back inside to finish that scene. This all happened before Patty Duke was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 1982. Astin says prior to that, his family didn't really have a vocabulary for what they were experiencing at home. Duke would become erratic and violent, and Astin says he learned to protect himself. But when she recovered, she would apologize and feel guilty about the abuse. What Astin and his family experienced is not uncommon. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, nearly 1 in 5 U.S. adults live with a mental illness. Those individuals are our family members, friends, neighbors, and community members. Perhaps everyone knows someone who is struggling with a mental health issue. Patty Duke spent much of her life advocating for mental health awareness. And now her son, Sean Astin, is continuing to spread that message. He travels the country and shares his story with the hope of eliminating the stigma of mental illness and helping families like his own. He's going to be in Rochester next week as the keynote speaker for East House's annual Hope and Recovery Luncheon. We'll talk with representatives from East House this hour, coming up later. But first, we got a chance to talk with Sean Astin. Sean, we welcome you to Connections. Let me start by asking you, you know, when you think about your mom, what is... It's a complex portrait, I'm sure, but what comes to mind first when you think of your mother?
So my mom passed away a little over 3 years ago. And what I've noticed is that the farther away we get from her life, the more I instinctively remember the good things. A lot of the negative aspects of her mental illness that informed, you know, a lot of my childhood and a lot of my kind of early adult experience and thinking are kind of drift away a little bit in a weird way that I wouldn't have anticipated. So I think a lot about just shared experiences, things we did, you know, times early in life that, it's just weird. You know, I have 3 daughters now and we talk a lot about Nana. And, you know, there are moments where it seems really relevant and useful to talk about her diagnosis and her, you know, some of the more traumatic experiences. But, you know, she had a dog fetish. My mom had tons of dogs, you know, throughout our whole life. And so when we were at a moment where, you know, our 17-year-old's getting ready to go off to college and there's a thought of like, hey, maybe she'll bring a dog with her. We spent all this time talking about Nana and her dogs and how she named them. And do you know what I mean? So it's when I do these speaking engagements, I'm talking from historical memory. You know what I mean? Where there's certain lessons and experiences that I have that I think are kind of indelible, but in a beautiful way, it's not the first thing that comes up for me anymore.
Yeah, your mother was Patty Duke, who obviously our listeners know of her and maybe know more of the public side of Patty Duke. But when you think about the things that you went through as her son, and you think about the mental illness that she battled, are you concerned that the public associates mental illness with either violence or volatility in a way that we have to have a nuanced discussion of how these things tie together? But are you worried that the public leaps too quickly to assuming that mental illness equals violence or volatility?
it's just so funny that you talk about how the audience might know about my mom's public life, where, you know, meaning her career and her successes and so forth, where to me, her diagnosis as a person suffering from bipolar disorder and her journey to wellness and her, you know, that just that whole struggle was as public as anything. She was, you know, she broke a lot of ground as one of the first kind of really recognizable people to talk about bipolar disorder. I think depression and other, you know, other mental health concerns have been, you know, popularly discussed and understood and written about and grappled with for millennia. But bipolar disorder was a relatively new thing. And so the fact that my mom talked about it a lot really was really helpful for a lot of people. And she wrote about it and she toured the country giving speeches about it and so forth. And I talk a lot about how when, you know, your audience that's my age or older will remember Larry King as the kind of go-to voice in the national conversation whenever some drama would happen, some shooting or, you know, just some kind of violent exchange that had to do with mental illness. And my mom was one of the boxes on the screen. You know, I remember Muriel Hemingway was there when sort of talking in an authoritative way about depression. And my mom was like the bipolar person. And she would talk a lot about what your question gets at, which is just this idea of, you know, not all people who have this, this affliction are violent people, that it's not fair to the vast majority, if not nearly all of the people who have bipolar disorder, for the public conversation always to swirl around violence. So you talk about a nuanced conversation. I mean, absolutely critical that people talk about, you know, just what it's like, you know, kind of finding a wellness strategy that works for people and how families can, you know, what the family experience is of, you know, helping everything from, you know, a time before a diagnosis is achieved and when and what to do in that kind of when just that process of waiting and helping someone be willing to, you know, even just talk to healthcare professionals, mental health care professionals. And then, you know, my experience is that even once there's a diagnosis and a plan and you know, a sort of treatment plan underway, including, you know, pharmaceuticals and all that stuff, like that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning. And finding, just kind of coping strategies and just finding out how to be, you know, how to be, how to live, and knowing that there are other people around who are having a similar experience, you know, where violence isn't, you know, violence is what triggers the public. I mean, it's great that this is a public, you know, kind of broadcasting interview and we're talking about something in a kind of calm context. But I mean, let's be honest, it's when something goes really wrong that all of a sudden everyone, you know, the alarm bells go off and all the news is triggered and everyone sort of thinks, let's pay attention to it. When anyone in the mental health care field knows that the only way to avoid that is by having these kinds of conversations earlier. So, I mean, it's obviously not just a great question, it's the question of the moment.
And so,
I would hasten to add that it's gotten so much better since my mother in the mid 80s first started talking publicly about her experience. It's a different conversation now. It is a much more nuanced conversation now. The general public, I think, has developed a comfort level. I mean, just since, I don't know, like the Oprah Winfrey show and all of the kinds of, I mean, everyone has come to realize that mental health challenges affect everyone. If it doesn't affect you personally directly, then it almost certainly affects your family or your extended family or your friends or colleagues in your work community. Like, you don't have to go too far away from most people's experience to see that everyone is kind of touched by this. So, and that has made it a lot easier, I think, for people to to feel more comfortable, a little more comfortable seeking help. And also it makes people who, you know, are kind of like taking that step to have a conversation with other people about their life and their experience and mental health. You know, it doesn't take that long for them to feel a little bit of support in the community and a sense that, you know, they're not alone. There's sometimes a sinking, horrible feeling. Like, oh no, like this is my experience. Is this going to be my whole life? You know, all of that. But I just think that it's so easy to point out, you know, what's lacking and what's wrong in the conversation, but it's really important to also recognize how far the conversation has come.
So when it comes to understanding mental health and the challenge from the perspective of a family member or a friend, you know, you're right. We can all think of someone in our lives, whether it's ourselves or others. But I want to ask you from the perspective of someone who, you know, you went through a lot when it comes to abuse, knowing that your mother loved you, and you certainly don't doubt that. But there are questions about how to be helpful and how to hold someone accountable without enabling. That's one of the hardest things for people who are working with a family member or a friend, because what you realize is the challenge is very much true and real and not imagined. And you want to give space to understand that, while also saying you've got to be held accountable if you are doing something that is hurting others. How do we sort of navigate that?
Well, okay. So first thing I have to say, you know, like out loud, is I'm not an expert. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a medical professional. And when you get into this part of the discussion, you know, when I'm talking at, you know, at public events or something like that, I just kind of say and repeat, like, you know, I'm not a professional. But what I do have is, and you're putting your finger on, is my own experience. And that's a place that obviously I can speak from that. And the fact that I've been talking, you know, around, this conversation because of my mom and her public posture, and just when you are willing to put yourself out there a little bit, it's amazing how much stuff comes to you, how much people want to share their experience and ask these questions and so on and so forth. So what I would say, with that caveat, what I would say is that the most important thing for people to do is protect themselves. You know, it's really, really hard because, you know, families in particular, like, you want to help someone that's suffering. But before you can really be of any use to anyone else, you kind of have to make sure that your own kind of mental framework is as stable as it can be, and that you don't expose yourself to I mean, it's really hard when you're living with someone and something's happening. But just knowing that, just in your own mind, to say, like, hey, you know, there's a chance that you're not going to be able to help this person in the way that you might want to, or you may think you're going to be able to help somebody and you fail at that. And that's like, you know, you can't beat yourself up about it. It's a counterintuitive thing to say, because, you know, people are like, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? And I think one of the first most helpful things you can do is, like, you know, take yourself out of the, like, you're the only person can help frame of mind, because then that what you can end up doing is actually pushing someone farther away, because you have something, you're so invested in helping the other person that you may lack the objectivity to be as helpful as you can. So it's like such a weird thing to do when people are like, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do to help? And you're like, well, maybe back off a little bit in your own mind a little bit. And realize that you may not be like the one and only solution. So what you're talking about in your question is, like, goes to the core of why I think it's valuable for me to talk to other people about it. Because in my experience, like, when my mother was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and she really sort of embraced her diagnosis, I mean, to an almost ridiculous extent, she, because she was living in the public eye, because a lot of her they used to call it manic depression, and her mania or her ups or whatever was, and her downs, but mostly her ups, caused such kind of reputational damage to herself. You know, she was erratic, and I think it took, before she married my father, she had damaged her career. And, you know, I think the stability that my father provided her and me growing up kind of created a space for her, you know, to claw her way back on that. And obviously her diagnosis was helpful too. But even starting to take lithium, and she's a very, very bright woman, very, very intelligent. She was the president of the Screen Actors Guild of the Actors Union. She instantly became a kind of pseudo expert, and then maybe over time an actual expert. But what was so maddening to me was that she would go out into the world and she would speak with, you know, authority about this illness and what it's like to not be shamed by it and what it's like to, for her, it was all about destigmatization. She wanted to use her public voice to help destigmatize mental health, which in a weird way, I mean, I think it's so much of that work has not been done, but it's just come so far that now the conversation is, as you said, much more nuanced and stuff. But within our family, she was just as toxic a lot of the time and just as abusive, maybe even more so some of the time. So we had to live with this kind of hypocrisy that she was helping all these people, but you know, it was a long road to hoe, particularly when she got divorced from my dad. And, you know, there are just some basic things that she was not great at in terms of just how she lived her life, just certain basic functions that, you have to eat well, you need to get some sort of fitness, you need regular sleep. You know, she smoked and drank cigarettes, and her sleep patterns were erratic. And, you know, you wonder, like, is what, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Does the fact that she has this illness sort of cause her to behave in ways that were not healthy for her, or does the fact that she lived in unhealthy ways exacerbate her illness? You don't really know. What we knew was, like, there was a problem going on. And even though she was diagnosed, even though she accepted her diagnosis, even though she had a wellness plan, even though she regularly took her medicine, it was still really hard. So, accountability, I mean, there's no, we're accountable to ourselves and we're accountable to each other in our family relationships. And people generally know when they've been, almost use a coarse word there, but cruddy to each other in a relationship. And whether you have mental illness or not, it's really hard to kind of resolve conflicts with family members, mothers, fathers, children, siblings. You know, it's just hard. And we aren't generally equipped in this society to have the vocabulary, to have the patience, to have the space where we know how to do that. I mean, problems that exist in families can last for years and years before, you know, enough time goes by for people to be, for the acuteness of the pain to kind of wane a little bit. And then, you know, you sort of miss being together and you do that. So, the one thing that I would say about my family is, you know, as filmmakers and people in the entertainment industry or where communication and language is sort of kind of required in order to do your job well, we did have that advantage. We were talkers. We were a talky family. You know, well, this is what I feel and this is what I have to say. You know, we were nobody had a hard time, you know, waxing on about what their problems are. And just speaking out loud about what your experience is and what your pain is and knowing that you're being listened to is it's just good medicine. You know what I mean? It's just really helpful. And we did have that going for us.
Talking to Sean Astin, actor who is going to be the keynote speaker for East House's 11th annual Celebration of Hope and Recovery Luncheon. That is coming up Thursday, September 26th at the Joseph A. Floriano Rochester Riverside Convention Center. And you can attend. They would love to see you there. Sean, of course, is known for his work on screen in so many different roles, but also for his work of advocacy. He's the son of Patty Duke, who did a lot of advocacy, and we're talking about what that means in so many different ways. And so, Sean, when we talk about holding people accountable, even people who are struggling with mental illness, for what they have done, that is one thing. There is a current debate that's happening on the national level about whether it is possible to prevent someone who has mental illness from becoming violent. And, you know, if you're willing, I'd love for you to weigh in on what we've heard from this administration, which the president recently said, quote, mental illness and hatred pull the trigger in mass shootings, not the gun. And the White House is considering a proposal understandably controversial, to study whether mass shootings could be prevented by monitoring people with mental illness for small changes that could foretell violence in the future. What do you make of that?
Well, it doesn't sound very helpful, at least not the way it's framed and characterized. I think it's really, really, really important for the public to know that, you know, the conversation that's happening there is, you know, the vast majority of people who are engaged, have mental illness or whatever, don't come anywhere near even remotely this conversation. And of course, the problem is that it sort of rethrows the blanket of suspicion and doubt and judgment back over the conversation. It's like, oh man, we just had the hardest, longest time just pulling those covers back and realizing like, oh, well, that's not helpful. You know, there's also one of the reasons people suffer for a long time is that they're afraid to communicate their experience. They're afraid to accept what others are kind of observing about them because they're afraid that they're going to be judged. They're afraid that their freedom is going to be curtailed. And that kind of conversation on a national level is just, it just exacerbates that. It's like, you know what? Don't help, please. You know, we of course, early warning signs of violence happen everywhere. It's very rare that you see some sort of a violent act happen where you can't go to somebody who's around that person who had thoughts or feelings of that. So we have a national conversation that is, you know, much broader than mental illness. It just has to do with like, how do we relate to one another? How do we express our concerns? Where can we go if there's if we have these kind of concerns? And you know, hopefully we'll develop strategies, draconian kind of, you know, Orwellian strategies is what that kind of language conjures up. And it's just going to suppress people's, it's going to push it back. It's going to like make it worse. It's going to make it harder when you make people think like, oh, there's going to be some sort of like government agency that is boring in on all of our lives. But you know, the politics of that, the kind of naked politics that surround gun reform and whether or not, you know, should have background checks, whether or not people should be qualified to use, you know, firearms, like that whole conversation, it's really important, I think, to speak more responsibly about it. So, you know, partisanship aside, you know, any kind of situation like that, any kind of government reform of that kind that you're describing where, you know, people are being monitored, like before they do anything. We have a constitution in this country, you know, and that protects against illegal search and seizures, that protects people's right, you know, speech rights and religious rights and everything else. And I have a feeling that the kind of programs that are being discussed there are going to end up, you know, colliding with a lot of those other freedoms that as Americans we enjoy. But from a mental health conversation, it's like, you know what, let's separate out the kind of straw man, boogeyman arguments that come up when these sorts of things happen. Like, you know, there's a total abdication of responsibility, not just from the administration, but from government as a whole. Mostly because, like, it's really hard to figure out what to do. But when it comes to guns and the immediate and the persistent kind of outcry there is to like try to do something about the scourge of gun violence, you know, to kind of redirect or misdirect people into these kind of broad brushstroke characterizations of people who are struggling with mental illness it's just not helpful. And it's not helpful even if there's truth to it. If there's truth to it, let's find a way to talk about it more constructively. So, you know, hot button issue. You know, voters should be informed, you know, and it's really hard to be informed because the way that these issues are talked about and presented to the public are oversimplified and you know, I could go on and on and on about it. But I think my time is best spent speaking like from my personal experience and connecting with people who are looking to see that there are other people like them who have similar experience and to have their reality reflected back to them from a place of compassion And, you know, so I have to be careful not to go too far down the politics
sure.
road, because it's definitely, it animates everything. It's the first thing that people know about and think about and talk about, because that's what's in the news every day. And it's like, well, there are people on the front lines out here trying not to have reactionary, rhetoric be the beginning, middle, and end of the conversation.
So with all of that in mind, tell us a little bit more about the mission behind the Patty Duke Mental Health Project.
Well, this was an idea that I had, during my mom's life, the last few years of our life, we talked about this. And right when she passed away, I had this instinct that, you know, people, you know, it's the kind of Twitter waves that happen. I knew that there's so much love for her that, you know, so I just, you know, went right in the moments, like literally the moments after she passed away. And it was probably part of the grieving process too, or the shock or whatever, or my instinct for salesmanship. I just threw up a CrowdRise site, and people donated, I think it was up to $60,000. So that $60,000 has been just sitting there waiting to figure out what to do. I mean, I thought about doing a 5K mental health expo where she lived in Coeur d'Alene. And the mission of it was simply to continue her, her mission to reach out and try and destigmatize what it means to be living with a mental health condition and so forth. So, so that's it. I don't want to overstate what it is, because it hasn't done anything yet. It's just sort of waiting for direction and inspiration and you know, like that. But I mean, I'm sort of doing it, you know, I'm sort of doing the heavy lifting with that, just in terms of going around the country talking about this stuff. So,
well, and before we let you go here, obviously our listeners know you from the many roles that you have played over the years, from The Goonies, Rudy, Lord of the Rings, Stranger Things, among many others. And, you know, what we know is that the entertainment industry can be a hard one to work in. There can be particular challenges when kids grow up in that industry. Looking back now, I mean, you're still doing great work, but are you glad that your mom wanted you to be in that industry and gave you that push? Are you glad to have done the work you've done?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the one thing that my mom did for me was she tried to correct, in a weird way, her experience as a child performer. She suffered mental abuse, sexual abuse, challenges in the workplace before there were a lot of rules established for, you know, conditions for kids who work. So I think she wanted to kind of prove to herself and the world that it was possible not to have that experience and to enjoy a good career. So she made that available to me. And, you know, I wasn't sure when I was a kid what I wanted to do with my professional life. And it was made very clear to me, and I felt empowered to not feel beholden to the industry. I never felt like this is what I had to do. It wasn't until I thought I might be a political figure. I thought I might be a teacher. I didn't know what I wanted to do. But I was so fortunate that I just kept getting offered these parts, or if an audition would come up and I'd think, yeah, I'd like to do that, I could go in. And some of the time I got those jobs. But when I was 18, coming back from doing Memphis Belle in Europe, which was an incredible experience in of itself, just the learning experience of that and the camaraderie working with those actors. That's the B-17 bomber World War II movie. But it was very, very clear to me coming back from that I didn't have any sort of formal training or formal technique. I had, you know, the training that my father, John Astin, had given to me. And I had the kind of ethos, the professionalism that my mom instilled in me. But that wasn't the same thing as having a kind of a craft that had been developed. So I actually decided at that point at 18 that I needed to study formally. And I was lucky enough to have access to the Stella Adler Conservatory in Los Angeles. And I started doing that. So that was an adult choice I made. mean, you're pretty young at 18 still, but it was a conscious decision I made to, you know, formally pursue this craft. And, you know, I always understood and appreciated the power of it. So I've never regretted for a second the fact that I went into this line of work. I've been, you know, if anything, just incredibly grateful for it. You know, I know that a lot of people who want to do it very badly struggle and can't find a way to break in. And so I'm pretty respectful of that. And I also, you know, I got my degree from UCLA in history and literature. I've done a lot of other things in my life that, you know, if you go to the website and you look through the bio, you're like, wow, geez, when'd you get all that done? but I have. And so it's been a liberating thing. I mean, you can make really, really good money if you're working. And maybe it's harder now, actually, with all the channels and stuff. But growing up for me, I was able to put myself through college and put my wife through college with me. And, you know, we have this beautiful family of three daughters and they're well cared for. So, you know, it's like to not be, there was never a second that I was not grateful for this. There were times when I thought about focusing on other stuff, but it's always been, and that's why, you know, just to sort of zero it in on the mental health thing. Options are really important. And for me, I always had them. For a lot of people who are, dealing with mental health challenges, it feels like there's no options ever. And I just try to encourage people, like, you know, what you're experiencing right now is not, or even if it's the family members I'm talking to, this isn't the end state of your life. Like this isn't permanent. That there's a way for you to, you know, there's help out there. There's people who care. There's services and resources available. And it's a process to be sure, but, their options will come, and seeking them out and taking advantage of them is, you know, one of the great keys to success in this life, realizing that there's lots of things you can do. Not to feel burdened by the immediate circumstance you're in, and just knowing sure. that there's other cool stuff out there.
Well, last quick question, then we'll let you go. We really appreciate the time. You know, you just happen to have been in a lot of films and shows that when they come out, they may be loved or highly watched, but they have staying power over the years, and we keep going back to them. But that doesn't mean all artists feel that way. You talk to musicians, you talk to actors. Some like to go back and revisit their stuff, and some go, yeah, I haven't seen that in years, or I haven't listened to that song in years. Is there a particular film or work that you did that you are most proud of, or you know, if you happen to come across it, you go, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to watch this, I'm going to enjoy this?
You know, I go to a lot of regional Comic-Con conventions, and which, you know, they're paid public appearances, and I have a great time doing them. And I end up meeting with literally hundreds of people in a weekend. And there's a constant kind of, treadmill of my past films and TV shows and work and so forth that's represented to me with people talking about it anew. So I actually, in a weird way, at this phase, given that these conventions are out there, feel like, you know, pretty connected to my body of work. Yeah. It's like I'm constantly seeing it. It just depends. If I come across something on the satellite, if I come across, even the cringeworthy stuff, and there's a lot of cringeworthy stuff that I've done in my career. I think, I don't know if it's just the age that I'm at, you know, I'm 48 and pushing 50 here. I just have a sense of humor about things. There's a movie that I did with my mom called, I think it was released as Bigger Than the Sky. And it's this wonderful kind of satirical take on, or whimsical take, I should say, on community theater. It's set in Portland, Oregon. And we just had a ball, and she plays two characters the way she did in the Patty Duke show when she was a kid, this kind of, you know, uptight administrative person in the theater on the one hand, and then when you go around the curtain, she's this kind of bawdy, saucy wardrobe person who's, you know, and I play this just raving, pompous actor, self-centered, conceited actor, and it's just a hoot. And if that's ever, I watch that. If I catch a piece of it, I'm like, ooh, I want to watch that. There's just something about it that that touches a you know it clicks a lot of it takes a lot of boxes for me that one. So, but you know, they you know all the big ones, you know, all the Goonies and Rudy and Lord of the Rings, and I mean, you know, I don't know. It nowadays you're just never that far away from anything. It's all just kind of in your face.
Yeah.
And my thing is when my kids watch something, you know, I was shooting Stranger Things 2 in Atlanta, and they came, Christine, my wife, and Elizabeth and Bella came to visit me, and we all kind of cuddled up in bed, and we were at the hotel, and we were going to watch something, and we turned it on, and I don't know if it was TNT or whatever, but Lord of the Rings Return of the King was 10 minutes in, and I kind of, you know, I kind of like held my breath looking around like, you know, I don't think I never get in charge of the remote control. So whoever was in charge of the remote control, and Elizabeth, my middle kid, was like, "Well, let's watch this." And Belle was not happy. "No, I don't want to watch it." and my wife always kind of rides these dynamics. She sort of, you know, doesn't say anything at first, and she kind of sees the way it's going, and then she sort of decides, you know, which way to encourage it to go. And the cool thing was, because there were commercials, you know, it was scary. That's why there were scary bits in it. And that's what Bella was responding to. But there were commercials. So we'd mute during the commercials, and I would have an opportunity to explain what she'd just seen and what was coming up. So it made it take 15 hours to watch it. But I was just tickled pink at enjoying them sort of discover Lord of the Rings for the first time. And Elizabeth just kept saying, you know, "Wow, Dad, you're like so good in this." I was like, "Oh, thanks, honey." She's like, so she kept repeating it over and over and over again. Like,
she shouldn't be surprised, Sean.
Oh, well, you know, and well, this is how, you know, we turned it off. And, you know, once the conversation was finally over, I found myself, you know, for several days, like, "So did you really think I was good in it? Like, but really, what did you really think?" "Yeah, Dad, you're," and then finally, you're like, "Dad, enough, you know, you were good in it, not enough to, you know." So kids keep you honest whether you want them to or not.
Well, it's a great story, and we appreciate all of them and more, and we'll see you in Rochester on Thursday, the 26th of September, coming up here as part of the 11th annual East House Celebration of Hope and Recovery Luncheon. Thanks for the work you're doing, and thanks for the time.
I'll say one last thing, and that is that when I go around East House, their mission is pretty cool, and one of the things that happens when I come in is I get a tour of, you know, the facility or at least of some of the personnel and stuff. And, you know, a lot of times people have no idea what to do or where to go or how to start a process for themselves or to help their family member or friend or colleague or whoever. And this is like, I get to learn about all the places that, you know, there's a place in Houston. I went, there's just all these places that are out there, and they have these luncheons both to kind of celebrate their achievements. But they also want people to know like who they are and what they're doing. So people, if they don't know anything about it, or, you know, if they're curious about, you know, the kinds of resources that are available, this is the kind of thing to come to.
Awesome stuff. Hey, thank you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much. Be well.
Coming up in our second hour, the Finger Lakes is known as a region for its wine production. Certainly beer is a big part of the upstate New York scene, but what about cider? How familiar are you with cider? We're not just talking about the kind of cider that your kids were drinking. We're talking about all kinds of drinks, different years old, different varieties of apple, and a lot more. We dig into the Cider Week celebration coming up next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You just heard Sean Astin, longtime actor who's coming to Rochester 9 days from now, September 26th, that's next Thursday, for the annual Hope and Recovery Luncheon for East House. And the president and CEO of East House, Kim Brumber, is here. Kim, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Also with us here is Chuck Montanti, who's a board member for East House and president of Westfall Associates. Chuck, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
And Beth Bloom is here, a peer support specialist at East House. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Well, you know, Beth, I want to start with you here because I know you heard a lot there that that some you might be able to relate to, and other aspects, you know, every story is a little different. But you've described East House as a place that saved your life. Why do you say that?
Well, I was at a place in my life where I was very depressed. I'd lost two very important people. Within 3 weeks, and I just was lost. I have had a fantastic therapist who help me. And finally, she said, why don't you go talk to these people? And I did. I sat down with the admissions person, and she said, I think you'd be a great fit for our programs. And that was 18 years ago, maybe. And I started working while I was still a client and continued on.
When you were in that moment of looking for help, what was the hardest part for you dealing with what you had lost?
Feeling so alone, feeling like I was the only person who was going through that kind of pain at the time.
How quickly or not did you come to realize that going to East House was going to make a change for you? Because everyone's experience is different. And for those of us who have friends or family or ourselves in taking these steps, sometimes there's resistance, sometimes it's slow. What was it like for you?
I think at first I was concerned. You know, I was going outside of my comfort zone. I had not ever been involved with any kind of community mental health systems at all. But I had great luck in dealing with the counselors and the staff members who were so welcoming and so willing to kind of go the steps with me to help me towards my recovery.
How long did it take before you decided in your own mind that you felt differently, that there was enough progress for you? Because there's probably not for most people a moment where you feel, quote, better or whatever the case may be, but how long until for you, you knew that this was the path you needed to be on?
Oh, it was well into 10 years. Wow. And actually, for me, it was an actual moment.
Oh, it was?
I was walking my dog, and we were on our usual afternoon route. And all of a sudden, I just had a sense of not feeling that crippling depression and that terrible anxiety. And I thought, oh, well, you know, this can't last, but it has.
You're thinking, this is new?
Yes, this is unheard of.
What was that like for you, knowing how common that depression and anxiety had been?
Once I understood that I wasn't the only person and that lots of other people were struggling either with anxiety or depression or whatever myriad of mental health issues that we deal with at East House, I felt welcomed. I felt a part of something, and I wanted to give back, and I've had that opportunity.
No, it's great. And when you're walking the dog in that moment, did you think, that lack of depression and anxiety, did it feel like a weight had been lifted? Was it almost frightening that it was different?
No, it was a weight lifted. It was just, I don't really know how to express it because it really was a feeling, but it was just kind of a, almost like a lightning strike, and I felt better.
You're a peer support specialist now.
I am.
Again, every person is different. Every person has different needs, but how do you approach the work now?
Well, as peer support specialists, my colleagues and I at East House have lived experience that we're able to share with our clients and with other staff members. Everybody in the mental health field kind of has a niche, but as peers, the niche we have is we've been there and we've done that, and that there is hope and that recovery is possible and that every person's recovery will look different.
Talking to Beth Bloom, a peer support specialist at East House. And Kim, you know, listening to Sean Astin, he says part of what his work around the country is about is helping communities see the resources that are there in their communities like East House. So give me the scope and the scale of East House, how many people you work with, how many people you employ. Give me that sense.
Sure. East House every year serves about 1,600 individuals. We have a team of roughly 200 employees spread out over 10 different residential facilities. Our work is, it's a residential model, so we house people as kind of the foundational piece of the first step of recovery. And we move people through increasing levels of independence as they're ready. And then we also have wraparound support services such as education, care management, and other comprehensive supports for the individual.
How long is an average stay in that initial housing?
The initial housing, depending upon the program the person enters into, it could be as short as 3 to 6 months or a year and a half.
Okay. And you've obviously seen tremendous results, but for people listening who are wondering if East House is right for them or someone they love or care about, what's the message for anybody wondering, I don't know where to go, you know, what's the right fit for East House?
Sure. It's probably not healthy for me to define the fit, but what I would say is I would encourage you to call East House.
Okay.
We have a very robust admissions group that if you're not a fit for East House, we are connected to all the community resources, and they can at least give a guiding direction on next step.
What did you make of what you heard with Sean there?
Interesting story. I also grew up with mental illness in my family, so I relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the work that he does by going out around the country, part of what I see the opportunity in this luncheon is just lifting the stigma. Every single conversation is important in lifting the stigma. And every day I hear stories of the stigma getting in the way of someone getting the help they need.
Chuck, what did you make of Sean's stories?
I was impressed with the advocacy that he drew out of his life experience. The thing that impresses me about him and what East House does is it's such an essential piece of the biological, psychological, and social tools that people need in order to find true recovery. As a mental health clinician, I can't imagine working without the resources of something like East House to take care of some of the social needs. We can help people with medications, we can help people with therapy, but without a safe place to live in a nurturing environment, we would be operating without all the tools we need.
Chuck, how much progress have we made in, say, the past generation or so in working through these issues?
It's been light years of difference. There was a time when it was taboo to even acknowledge mental illness in one's family. The fact that somebody like Sean can come to communities, be welcomed, and spread the word about the access to care, this is something that could not happen even 25 years ago.
Beth, how do you feel about that term stigma? I mean, you know, you're someone who benefited from East House. You work with people at East House now. How do you view seeing that change over the years, if you've seen it change?
I think primarily I see it as people's internalized stigma of having either a mental health diagnosis or a substance use disorder. I think people carry a lot of shame. I have talked about this within my work, but for example, my dad is now living with us and he's never heard this story. So he's out there and, you know, at home listening to the story. And I realized that, you know, mental health impacts every family. I mean, within my family, within Kim's family, mental health issues cause such destruction, and nobody wants that for themselves or the people they love.
Yeah, Chuck, maybe just 1 minute, just briefly here. This is an important point from that Beth's raising. Certainly as a society, we can do better not to stigmatize. But what Beth is raising is there's also anxiety on the part of people with mental health challenge to assume they're going to be stigmatized or to be embarrassed about it in some ways. How are we dealing with that?
Well, the social side of recovery involves not only the individual, but also the whole family. The stigma lives not only within the individual, as Beth said, but also within the family. So to be able to reach out to family members and help them understand that the no-talk rule of mental illness, of chemical dependency, is part of the disease, not part of the recovery.
About a minute left here. So, Kim, tell our community what you want them to know about 9 days from now. The event is the annual Hope and Recovery Luncheon. That's Thursday, September 26th.
Yes, Hope and Recovery Luncheon. Sean Astin will be there speaking. Tickets, $75. VIP reception ahead. If you sign up for that, your ticket is $175. You can find information on www.easthouse.org.
Easthouse.org. Sean Astin is going to be there. And how important is this event for you? In the scope of a year, how important is this event for you?
This event is critical. This event raises private dollars, which allow us to really do the extra that allows our clients, instead of to just sustain, to actually fulfill their own human potential. So this really makes a difference.
You can see Sean Astin and join the event, the annual Hope and Recovery Luncheon, next Thursday at the Joseph A. Floriano Rochester Riverside Convention Center. And Kim, good luck with that. And thank you for the work you're doing in this community. Thank you for being here. Chuck Montanti, thank you for your perspective as well, and thanks for being here.
Glad to do it.
And Beth Bloom, congratulations on continued recovery and the work that you're doing for people in our community. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for this opportunity.
You got it. Our thanks to Sean Astin as well, joining us earlier this hour. More Connections coming up.